Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the New York Public Library and to what I know will be a terrific evening. I'm Jean Strauss, the director of the Coleman Center for Scholars and Writers here upstairs. We're delighted to have you all here for tonight's conversation between two extraordinarily gifted writers, Francine Prose and David Besmozgis. This is the last of the season's public programs from the Coleman Center. If you're not on our email list and would like to get advance notice of what we'll be doing next fall, please leave us your email on a list at the door as you leave, just outside the door. There'll be a table there. And looking back at the outstanding series of talks we've sponsored all year, I want to extend my warm thanks to Marie Dorigny, the Coleman Center's Manager of Public Programs, and to the other members of the Coleman Center staff, Katie Pyatt and Kelly Cook, who've been fabulous all year long, helping us getting these programs going. Francine Prose, whose deeply intelligent, witty, and beautifully written work includes novels, short stories, essays, journalism, criticism, children's books, and nonfiction, was in the first class of Coleman Center Fellows in 1999-2000. While here, she was working on a nonfiction book that came out in 2003, The Excellent Lives of the Muses, Nine Women and the Artists They Inspired. The pairs include Alice Liddell and Lewis Carroll, Hester Thrale and Samuel Johnson, Charis and Edward Weston, and Yoko Ono and John Lennon. Among Francine's other first-class nonfiction books are the best-selling Reading Like a Writer, a guide for people who love books and for those who want to write them, and biographies of Caravaggio and Anne Frank. Her many fine novels include Blue Angel, which was a finalist for the National Book Award, A Changed Man, Household Saints, which was made into a movie, Bigfoot Dreams, and now the very funny and trenchant My New American Life, just published last month. I'm not going to talk about the superb new novels by each of these writers, since they'll be talking about them in depth, and I hope you'll buy them tonight on your way out and read them yourselves. The writers have agreed to sign books afterwards, so there's a table out there for buying and then another one for signing. Francine has won the Rome Prize of the American Academy in Rome, as well as Fulbright and Guggenheim Fellowships, and she's a distinguished writer in residence at Bard College. David Besmozgis is currently finishing up a year at the Coleman Center. A Canadian, he's an award-winning writer and filmmaker. His first book, Natasha, a collection of stories, won the Commonwealth Writers Regional Prize for first book and was translated into more than a dozen languages. David was named one of the New Yorker's 20 under 40 top young fiction writers last spring. Please turn cell phones off. They usually don't work down here, so I don't have to say that, but somebody's got a good one. The New Yorker's 20 under 40 top young fiction writers last spring and has published stories there in The New Yorker as well as in Harper's, Zoetrope, and other magazines. His first feature film, Victoria Day, had its premiere in competition at the Sundance Film Festival in 2009. We actually had a showing this year at the Coleman Center. It's terrific, and I hope it gets into wide distribution someday. The book he's been working on at the Coleman Center is about a famous Russian Jewish dissident who, after the fall of the Soviet Union, meets the man who denounces him, who denounced him, to be called the Betrayers. His new book and first novel, The Free World, abundantly fulfills the promise that was so widely praised and deserved in Natasha and moves forward into new fictional and geographic territory. Both of the books we'll hear about tonight are full of sage humor, and both are They are profoundly stories about people finding themselves in new cultures, which holds mirrors up to those new spaces, to the places they've left, to individual character, and to history. Francine and David will talk for about 45 minutes and then take questions, and then they'll sign books. Please join me in welcoming David Besmozgis and Francine Prose.
You can start if you
like. So I'm always interested in the how did the book start question. How did the book start?
The book started sort of as a compliment to Natasha. So Natasha was about a family of Soviet Jews who arrive in North America and their experience there. But then there was everything that came before, which was a much larger story that I couldn't treat in Natasha and intrigued me. And so that was, to me, sort of like a compliment one complemented the other, and you put the two of them together and you tell the full story of the Soviet Jewish experience in the 20th century, to pick something modest and small. But I could ask you the same thing, because I'm pretty sure you're not Albanian.
I'm so not Albanian, although I may become an adopted Albanian soon, so the dual citizenship no one wants. I wish I could say that a book has ever started for me with an idea, or like, you know, oh, I'll write about immigration, or oh, I'll write about America in the Bush-Cheney years, but it started in the most absurd way, really. I got a call, or actually my agent, Denise, who's here, got a call from Lexus magazine. Lexus the car used to have a magazine called Lexus the magazine, and this is before the economy crashed, and they said they were running fiction. They were commissioning fiction, and first I said, well, I don't do that sort of thing. I don't write for car magazines, and I don't even drive. And then Denise said, well, maybe you should know how much they're paying before. And even though it was before the economy crashed, when I still sometimes said no, as opposed to now, I said, okay, and I'll think about it. And then I had a kind of a vision.
They don't give you a Lexus to write
this story. I said, I'll write for a Lexus. No, that was not going to happen. No, that was not what they were paying. So I had a vision of a Lexus SUV pulling up in front of this suburban New Jersey house and a girl looking out the window. And I said, oh, who's in the SUV? Three Albanian coke dealers. Now, I have no idea where this came from. And in fact, in the book, when it became a book, they're not coke dealers. They are Albanians. But and then when Lexus, the magazine, actually published it, by then the economy had crashed and they were an online magazine. They said, can you leave out the word Lexus? Because the Albanian coke dealer was not exactly the demographic that they were going after. So it kind of all spun out from that vision.
But the point of view is the girl looking out at them.
The point of view is the girl looking out at them. And I mean, the other thing I kind of remembered, and it was strange, I mean, it was just a strange, oh, well, you've had this experience. I mean, you're not as old as I am, so the memories don't come surfacing from so far back. But I remembered a story that a student told me. This was, oh, God, it must have been like 25 years ago. And she was Albanian. And she said, you want to know how I learned how to drive? And I'm fascinated by people's learn how to drive stories, since I don't know how to drive. And she said that these Albanian guys befriended her, these, you know, her countrymen, and they drove her to the middle of the George Washington Bridge and left her there. And they got out of the car. And I said, what happened? She said, I drove over there. And that, you know, it's not really a spoiler. That's how the novel ends. So I knew that that's what I was working toward.
Okay. Well, it's interesting because there's so much driving and the inability to drive and sort of neurosis about driving plays such a large part in the book.
I'm obsessed with it. I'm obsessed with it. I mean, I didn't have a license for a while, and then there was kind of a family intervention. Because I got my license too. You know, I grew up in New York, so we couldn't get our licenses till everybody was out of town already. So they, you know, my husband and kids got together and said, you've had so many fender benders, you're just a danger to yourself and everybody else. So I stopped driving. I mean, I have a license. You know what? Can this be turned? Can this be turned up? Or can this?
Can you hear us both equally?
No.
Really?
Uh-oh.
Okay, we'll try again.
We'll try again.
Is this better?
Yeah.
Yes.
Is this better? Is that? I still have to. Can it go up a little bit? Oh, well, I'll just scream. How would that do?
Yeah.
So, enough about my driving issues.
But, okay, because driving actually is interesting in the sense that it has something to do with the way the book treats America.
Yeah, because I've never really, even though I was born here, I've never really felt like an American because I can't drive. So
it was very peculiar for me to read a book from an American.
Another non-driver.
It was peculiar to read a. Whoa. How about now? Oh boy. It was peculiar to read a book by an American that was so, you know, that paid so much attention to driving and an anxiety about driving.
Mm-hmm.
And that it factored so much in the book. So it had something to do, obviously, with the suburbs and growing up in America, which is part of the story. But it seemed to play into... In talking about the family, I think we should talk about the family a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because the complement of characters is... So for the people who haven't read this book yet, I'll do a little
preview. Yeah, sure.
So there's Lula, who's...
A 26-year-old Albanian recent immigrant living semi-illegally in New Jersey, working as a nanny for Zeke, who's 17, who doesn't really need a nanny, but his father works on Wall Street and is neurotic, and a neurotic American father, and is afraid to leave his son alone at home. So Lula's kind of his paid friend.
Right.
And she makes sure he eats, for example, and kind of does his homework, although there's no on-screen homework being done. You may have noticed.
I did notice that. There's no on-screen homework. And he's only allowed to drive to this one,
organic market,
right? But it's this neurosis about, this
neurosis
driving.
About everything. I mean, how do you write about the United States? Or the middle class, let's put it that way. Or the upper, it's all neurosis. So we can come back to this, but there's something that I love about your book that I want to talk about, and that it made me realize. I mean, now that I've written a sort of immigrant novel, I can speak about it as a sort of genre, although I don't think it is one. But it made me realize what was missing from just about every other, not all, but most of the other immigrant stories and novels I'd read. Can you hear me now? Is that better? Which is that it's in most of those. People come here and they're almost already exactly like Americans, except they have funny names. I mean, they have the same problems we have, parents who don't understand them and ungrateful children and so forth. But there's almost no sense of why they left. And in my experience, people don't emigrate unless there's something wrong. I mean, the happy and the prosperous don't go through the trouble of going from one country to the other, but one of the great things about the free world is it's so steeped in history and in the reality of why this family, the Krasnodsky family, left Russia to go to Italy, where we meet them, and is about to go to Canada, they hope.
So that was, that was certainly part of the project of the book, which is to show how bad, to a certain extent, how bad life was in the former Soviet Union. But to give a full sense of why people left at that particular time and how different generations experienced it. So to understand why the people left. And beyond that, what their situation back home, how it affected them. And because ultimately these people end up in America. And so you have this community of, Russians and ex-Soviet people who come to America and... who in some ways seem abrasive or, strange or peculiar or whatever it is. And it's an attempt to try to to explain why they are the way they are. And I mean, I realize that I, as somebody who was born there, kind of have a foot in both cultures, am also writing mostly for an American audience. So I'm aware that Americans really don't know the history, for the most part, of the Soviet Jews and a lot of, the detailed Soviet experience. And so this is, what happened to them and why they are the way they are. But now, I speak Russian, and I grew up in this community. And even though I didn't come of age in that country, I feel like I kind of get it. But even that, having written it because I didn't come of age, there was also this anxiety of not getting it quite right. Then I read your book, and I thought, what would it be like to write intimately about another culture, a foreign culture? It's been done before, but that you're not a part of. And there are moments, there's like, I made one... God.
Bye.
I don't know what it is. I wasn't even touching it.
Should I turn off this one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Was it Francine's or David's?
I don't know.
How's this? Oh, nice. Even I can hear myself.
Now, what about me? Am I?
Okay. So there was this moment where Lula goes to a club, and it's an Albanian club, and they're all dancing at night. And she describes, I don't know if I have the line here, but she describes what the dancing is like and what it feels like. And my thought was, reading it, it's like what you're doing is, it's like it's the authority not only just to describe a foreign culture, but also to ascribe how a native person would feel about it. Which to me was kind of daunting about, you know, writing about Soviet people, because I'm part, you know, I'm of the culture and I'm not. But then I thought, you're doing that for a culture that isn't yours. And what did that feel like?
Well, it might be easier in a way. I mean, there's less worry about getting it wrong because I was sure that I was going to. But that, as you know, I said before, the club, the Albanian dance club, I did from YouTube clips, because it turns out that no Albanian ever goes out to party without a video camera. So I just, you know, you can Google New Year's Eve Albanian club, the Bronx, 2009, and just get dozens of clips. So the party was that. But I went to Albania, because that was the thing that I couldn't imagine. I couldn't imagine Albania because you can't do it on YouTube, as it turns out, because when people go to Albania and then they post, you know, usually it's people going home. It doesn't exactly have a thriving tourist industry yet. But they post pictures of castles and beaches and palm trees and so forth. And I just had a sense that it wasn't like that. And some of it was like that, but a lot of it wasn't like that. And also, people, I met people and I talked to people and got a sense. I mean, what I couldn't imagine was the thing that you knew firsthand from your family, which was what the old world had been like. Mm-hmm. And people told me things that went straight in the book that I could, like one young woman said that that after, who spoke perfect English, and I said, how did you learn to speak such great English? And she said, from watching SpongeBob SquarePants. After television became legal, after the dictatorship, they all got TVs right away. So the generation older than hers, they had Italian TV, so they all learned Italian. And her generation all learned from American cartoons. You know, spoke these little squeaky voices like SpongeBob. So, but I couldn't have made that up. I couldn't have made that up. So I felt, just to get it right at all, that I had to go. And you went back to Rome, right? Did you live there as a kid? You did live there as a kid, right?
My family, when we emigrated, we left the Soviet Union in 1979 and went through Ladispoli and Rome, which was how Soviet people got to North America. But then I was a boy at the time. I was six. And so I went back in 2004 to live there for 4 months just to be a foreigner in Rome, just to learn the streets, just to walk around. So I had it at my fingertips because, you know, Rome is deeply ingrained in the book and the streets are described, and for that reason. I guess the difference is that for me to go back to Rome, if we were to compare it to going to Albania, to go to Rome in 2004, there are no more Russians there. There are no more Russian, you know, that whole movement, that whole community that was there is completely gone, because the place was built in such a way that the Soviets were there to be processed to leave. So nobody really stayed. So to go back there, it was just to look at Rome in a place that wasn't there anymore. And to get all that domestic stuff, that's the one thing I had, you know, in Canada. Mm-hmm. So I went for the other thing.
So who's living in Ladispoli now? Albanians, right?
There would be somebody, yeah. If there's another, you know, there was a very famous market, the Porta Portese Bazaar, where the Russians used to be, but now it's Albanians or Bulgarians or whoever it is that's, you know, that's passing through or leaving through North Africa and all of that. You know, so you get a sense, even as you go to that market, what the immigrant sort of, you know, vibrancy was like, but it's, they're different immigrants.
Yeah.
So it's that.
Well, you know, one of the things that I thought was so brave and honest about your book was that it was so, the idea that people can be damaged by the world they come from in ways that just can't be reversed magically by emigrating. I mean, somehow there's so many novels about immigration in which people get to the United States and bingo, it's like a miracle cure. Like everything's just made right again. And I think that so many writers are so hesitant to bring people bad news of any sort that the sort of bad news, the bad news that says you're not going to be healed by your immigration experience too rarely makes its way into novels.
Well, I think that's true, but I think it's also true for certain generations. I mean, if the people who are older, that's typically they suffer the most because their lives have been lived elsewhere. I mean, in the book, there are three generations, and certainly the older generation has the hardest time. The people who are, you know, the sons who are in their 20s have it much easier, you know, as people in their 20s and 30s do. They're more adaptable. And not only are they more adaptable, they're also more, keen to adapt. When I think of, again, it's like these two books are written, they're separated by some 30 years, but there are these similarities, you know, because we are dealing with immigrants. Mine don't quite make it to America, but once they do, you kind of have a sense of what they'll be like. And yours is about, you know, people who are already there, but also, you know, from a communist background, and how that affects them. And in thinking about both of them, there's this sense that mistakes that you make in the East are really dangerous. Mistakes that you make in the West, you can kind of get away with stuff.
Yeah. Well, no one's watching in quite the same way. And there is, what do I want to say? There's not the sense, well, just on the, in the most basic sense of a secret police breathing down your neck. I mean, that, you know, certainly that. And I think Russia was like Paris compared to Albania. I mean, I very consciously set out to pick the most extreme psychotic dictatorship I could find just for, you know, because I was writing about the Bush-Cheney years, so I thought, boy, I'd better go pretty far to have something to contrast with what we have here.
It's true that Albania is crazy, absolute insane dictatorship, you know, and there was the pyramid scheme. Like, I was trying to see all the things that really lent, you know, this bizarre aspect to it. But it makes America look really good.
we don't have 70,000 concrete bunkers in a country the size of New Jersey. I mean, that was another shocking thing about Albania, even though I knew that they had them. You know, Enver Hoxha, the dictator, had these 70,000 bunkers built. I read today a travel book that described them as looking like vertical burials because they're these eye slits and then just a sort of little bald head. And they were made to be indestructible, and surprisingly they turned out to be indestructible, so no one can get rid of them. So every front lawn has three of these things. You know, and they'd have raves, the kids would have raves. I mean, Lula goes to raves in the bunkers and so forth.
Well, and she also says that a lot of people have their first sexual experience.
They have sex in the bunkers.
Is that true?
This is, at least my Albanian informants have told me it's true. They may be lying. I don't know.
And is that because there's not enough private space?
There's no privacy. Well, right. Like in the Soviet Union, I mean, they still, you know, now in the last 10 years or so, there's been an attempt to kind of smarten up the state socialist housing blocks by painting them bright colors. But, you know, they just look like these horrible buildings painted bright colors. Now they don't look like Miami, which is sort of the idea.
I think that too is one of those things that is so difficult for Westerners to kind of understand, is how little personal space there was. And so these people are living, she lives in this massive house in Jersey.
with nobody in it.
Right. Whereas in Albania, she had to have sex in a bunker because there was no place to go. And there's in my book, there's a moment where, you know, the main character really talks about that one of his really chief skills is being able to find a place to copulate.
Corners where no one's going to find it.
Like places where you can go. And in the Soviet Union, that was a real problem.
But a sense of how deforming it is that's what he thinks everybody's doing all the time. I mean, that woman who has no intention of doing that, that's what he assumes she's about.
Yeah, well, it's cultural misunderstanding.
Can we talk about humor?
Yes.
Because it seems to me that both books, someone has asked me to define Eastern European humor, and I don't know how to, but I feel that both of our books have a lot of it, and I don't know how to describe it. I just know it when I see it or hear it. But do you have any idea?
Well, I think it's sort of a, because where it's the place that's most dangerous, I think, creates the funniest people. You know, like if it's really really dangerous somewhere, as a response, you know, there's this sort of jaded, dark humor, and you see things starkly in relief. And I think that, you know, right. It's that kind of thing. And so there's a lot of, you know, false speech in the government, but people speak very directly to each other, right? Whereas here you can say anything you want, and people end up speaking in euphemisms right. to each other.
And also that jadedness is hilarious. I mean, that jadedness, because my Eastern European friends, they've seen it all and had it happen, and nothing surprises them particularly. I mean, Americans, you know, in a way, one of our best qualities is that we're always being surprised by things. But for the good, I suppose. But my Eastern European friends, I mean, I remember watching that prize fight where Mike Tyson bit the guy's ear off, you know, and the Americans in the room were just horrified. And there were two Romanians in the room, and they're going, whatever, you know, compared to stuff that we grew up with, this is like nothing. So, you know... I mean, and I felt like I was drawing on all of that to put into Lula and her been there, done that. You know, plus when you're 26, you're kind of above it all anyway, so.
Well, you were drawing from it. I'm also aware that an American is writing it. And it seemed like she was an opportunity for you to say things about America that maybe you couldn't have an American character say.
Right.
Which is strange because you're thinking them.
Yeah, I know. It's mirror. It's like what's that thing in you know the mirror? I mean, if you're looking in two mirrors at the same time, whatever that infinite regression. Yeah, I mean, because I had a lot to say. I wanted to say about this country, but I had it's you know you have to get up.
You didn't think you could have an American character say those things quite that way.
I didn't think an American would notice in quite the same way. I mean,
but
one
you're
of the,
an American.
yeah, who? Well, I. You know,
Can I read a couple things?
Yeah, sure.
So I just, they're under funny. I have a whole thing of funny. But it's of a particular type. So here's one. I'll read a few. They're so funny you won't even, like, time will just fly. She wanted to learn that American trick, staying young till 40. Some American girls even got better looking. Not like Eastern Europeans who started off ahead but fell off a cliff and scrambled back up a grandma. Here's another one.
Wait, but haven't you noticed that? I mean, I went
yeah.
to...
Yeah. That's
to,
why everybody's
I,
laughing.
Right, that's right. I mean, when was it? I think I went to St. Petersburg in like 1995, and I was struck by the fact that there were these beautiful young women, you know, Natasha's, beautiful young women, and then these grandmothers, and there seemed to be nobody in between. So what happened? What happens to them?
They got married.
They got married. Yeah.
They got worked like
mules.
They
married Russian guys, yeah. Right.
let me try something else. There are a couple here. There are more than a couple, but there are a couple that I've got. She'd seen guys on Fox News calling for every immigrant except German supermodels and Japanese baseball players to be deported. No questions asked. I'm surprised that they wouldn't call for Japanese baseball players, too, by the way.
Well, they can do. They have a skill, you know.
And here's another one. Okay, at home, no one thought about weight so much. Poverty and fear kept you thin, though strangely, in this country, they had the opposite effect.
Yeah, well, trans fat is kind of... corn syrup is a natural product. That's what we have here. Well... Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to. Yes, I'm an American, but you know that when you're writing, I mean, you're not a Russian grandfather who grew up under, you know, who was an ardent communist, like Samuel. Is that how you pronounce Samuel?
Samuel, yeah.
So part of the fun of writing, I mean, why bother to write fiction unless you get to not be you and look at the world through the eyes of someone who's not you? And that's it. And in a way, it kind of didn't matter that I was an American after a while, because I would go to my desk, and for several hours a day, I was an Albanian. Which was great. I mean, it was great. And you must have become all these other characters, because there's a shift. They're shifting points of view.
Yeah, I mean, there's a woman, and there's an old Russian communist man, and a young kind of womanizing Russian guy. And I'm all of those people, none of those people at the same time. I don't know about the woman, but so yeah, you take on those voices, and the characters exist. Because they didn't materialize out of thin air, it's like, well, how do you choose the complement of people? So there's this family, and there's an old communist grandfather, because there are old communist grandfathers, but also because he enables me to say something about Soviet life and immigrant life in a way. And there's the young wife who's not Jewish, but, you know, Latvian, Belarusian, who enables me to say something about Soviet experience that isn't exclusively Jewish. And so you put these people together that you hope they're going to exist as real people, but with this other awareness that they're going to enable you, they become a microcosm to represent something larger. So I was very conscious when I put this family together that they would, you know, enable me to talk about different aspects of immigrant life and Soviet life. At that point in time, which is 1978, and you have events happening.
And interestingly, the young woman is writing to her sister, and her relationship with her sister in letters is really pretty much the only relationship in the book that isn't poisoned in some way by the past.
Yeah, it's the only where she can speak, you know, honestly to her sister, and she can be vulnerable in a way that she can't be with her husband or his family. So it enables her to, you know, to speak, you know, from the heart. And I wanted her to have that. But by the same token, and I'm going to transition because I have a question that really relates to this, to your book, which is, so there's an epistolary part of my novel, and there's also a part where Samuel ends up writing, you know, what are ostensibly his memoirs, which that's also supposed to serve a purpose. But anytime you have, like, a text within a text, or somebody writing a memoir, to me, I get very conscious of it. Is it going to feel like a device? Are you going to be able to sell it? You know, because you know why it's there, but is it going to, you know, flow seamlessly into the narrative? And you have, in this book, Lula also writes in a different way. Maybe you can explain how it is and why it is that way.
Well, she's writing a memoir that's actually called My New American Life, and her boss, who she calls Mr. Stanley, and her immigration lawyer. I mean, Lula, she's so peculiar. You know, she can't call her boss anything other than Mr. Stanley, and it has to be spelled out M-I-S-T-E-R, yeah, because as far as she's concerned, that's his first name. And I had trouble with the copy editor who went and changed it all to M-R period. Yeah. And I had to go and change every single, you know, tell them to change every single one. And Don Settebello, her immigration lawyer, and they're both, you know, speaking of characters who are you, they're both me. I mean, her boss and her lawyer are me as much as Lula is, because they're both do-gooder Americans in the way that I think of myself, who just want to be helpful and help the immigrant, you know, in the same way. I mean, while I was writing this, I was teaching at Baruch, and all my students, of my 25 students, only 3 or 4 were native-born, and the rest were Lula, essentially. I mean, male and female. But they all had visa problems of one sort or another, and I was, you know, collecting cards from immigration lawyers who I met, and I'd say, wait, I have just the person for you. Anyway, so in their efforts to help Lula, Don, and Mr. Stanley persuade her to write a memoir of her old Albanian life and her new American life, and she just makes it up, all the Albanian stuff, because she realizes that they like all these Albanian folk legends, which are just not true. And, you know, stuff about bride kidnapping.
Where did you get the legends from?
Oh, just I got a book of Albanian fairy tales and just made them, you know, made them up. I mean.
And she says, these are stories her granny had
said. Yeah, she pretends they happened to her. But they didn't. But she knows perfectly well they didn't happen to anybody in Albania for like six generations back, you know, when they still had blood feuds and bride kidnappings and so forth. Because when I went to Albania, I kind of checked it out and I said, you know, what about the blood feuds? And they said, oh, it's all about real estate now. People are in court trying to get their property back. So, you know, all that romantic stuff was just not true anymore. But you know, and also, once you start writing the book, you figure out what you're writing about. And I realized that about halfway through that I was writing about compulsive lying. I mean, I was writing about America in 2005, Bush and Cheney. It was a society of compulsive liars, and everyone except for the teenage kid, I guess the boss, are just lying like crazy all the way through the book. So it made sense to me to have Lula's memoirs be a pack of lies. And of course, you know, as we all know, memoirs are. Never mind. I had a dream about James Frye the other night.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Wasn't good.
But when you introduced the writerly part of it, that she's, did that make you anxious at all?
No, it's fun.
Were you concerned of it as being divisive, which always makes me nervous? You know, Samuel's writing. Oh boy, he's writing now.
No, I mean, I like stories within stories. You know, I've always liked them from, you know, reading Garcia Marquez or Isaac Dinesen. I mean, that was sort of one of my favorite things about, or fairy tales, really. Someone in the middle of a story starts telling another story. And it's very liberating in a way. I mean, because it allows you to change the pace and change the tone and so forth. And so it never occurred to me that, you know, later, when I reached the stage of none of this works, you know, that stage, then I thought, oh, that doesn't work either. But then again, nothing else does, so why worry?
And coming back around to arranging, you know, creating the complement of characters, I mean, I know why my family members are the way they are. How did you decide on who the cast of characters were going to be and why they are the way they are?
Well, I knew there had to be a lawyer because she's having immigration problems. I knew that she had to have a job. So I thought, you know, what do people hire 26-year-old girls with no skills to do? And someone told me in the middle, right near the beginning, that there's a huge market in this country for English-speaking nannies. You can kind of name your price if you want to work as a nanny and speak English. So that made sense to me. And then who's she going to take care of? Actual children? No one would hire her to take care of actual children. So it could only be someone who didn't need caretaking. And then I put a best friend in there just to give her someone, you know, to play off against, and I had my cast.
But there's also, so she has this lawyer, but he's not just an immigration lawyer. I mean, so these characters end up, you know, performing, doing, you know, functioning in something, functioning in a way that says something about America at that moment.
I got really worried about halfway through. I got really worried. I mean, even though I think of myself as in some ways, a patriotic person. I mean, you know, teaching at Baruch made me patriotic for 6 months because, that class was the American dream. There were all these kids, and had come to this country for real reasons. It wasn't working out for them in Slovakia and Georgia and Ecuador, you know, for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And it was in some way working out for them. So there's that kind of patriotism. But I became worried that I was writing this kind of flag-waving hymn to American self-reinvention. So then I thought, okay, bingo, I make the lawyer have a kind of pro bono work in Guantanamo. Oops, the shadow of Guantanamo. It's all you need to put in the other side of American political life.
So that wasn't part of the conception from the beginning that he would be doing that.
No, and then I read all these books about Guantanamo to try and figure out.
And what about Mr. Stanley working on Wall Street? Was that there from the beginning?
That was there from the beginning.
Because
Wall Street was there from the beginning.
Because he talks about, like, you know, it's as if he perceives that this whole thing is going to fall apart.
Yeah. Well, that was there later, after it had fallen apart. because you know, I mean, the other thing, you know, well, I talk about this too. I mean, the way in which life while you're writing gives you things that you couldn't have imagined at the beginning. I mean, certainly that happened in the process of writing The Free World.
It's different because I was writing about something that was, you know, in the kind of not the distant past, but, you know, 30 years ago. So you see things reflect, you know, what you do see, particularly if you write about things like Israeli-Palestine issues, what's shocking is that nothing has changed, right? You read newspapers from 1978, and you could basically take that text and drop it into the present day, you know, both in an anti-Israeli way and sort of like in a pro-Israeli way. So that you see, and I guess that's kind of, on the one hand, encouraging and like, oh, yes, this is still, you know, this is still timely, this is still current. And on the other, it's like, oh, God, is this ever depressing?
Well, except that it's so, you know, as I said before, so brave. I mean, the other thing I was realizing when reading your book made me think about my dissatisfaction with the others is that the thing that's really hard for people to do is imagine the world from their parents' point of view. That just seems almost impossible for people. I mean, they can do almost everything. I mean, it's like imagining your parents having sex or something, like, ooh. But you did, I mean, those are presumably your parents and your grandparents' generation, and you, I mean, it's completely persuasive that you did it.
Well, I'm happy to hear that. Because the idea behind it was I didn't want to write a book where somebody tells their grandson, this is how it happened.
Right.
So it's this story that's mediated through, you know, or some, you know, somebody my age goes back and researches, oh, what was it like for mom and dad? Or what? Because that's the story that you want to tell. And then the leap is to go, well, let's take me out of it.
Right.
And see if we can do this in an unmediated way.
Well, the kids are just little presences on the edge of the narrative. I mean, having read Natasha, I thought, oh, well, yeah, I know what's going to happen to them. But in The Free World, they're just kind of, they're there, but they're not central figures.
Because they don't make any of the decisions.
Right.
They're insignificant. You know, the big decisions are being made by their parents and their grandparents. The risks are being taken by other people. And you know, because you don't have to talk about them, you know that things for them will basically work out.
You're right.
I wanted to say something. You know, you're talking about America, and you were concerned about flag waving, and we're talking about immigrants. And in reading it, I kind of formulated this idea. You can tell me if this sounds nuts.
Okay, here we go. I won't tell you if it's not, if I think it's nuts, but...
I'll say America, but we can say the West as well, that Americans are naive or idealistic about the rest of the world, but cynical about America. Foreigners are cynical about the rest of the world, but naive or idealistic about America or the West.
I think it's nuts.
You think that's nuts?
Yeah. Well, because I just think it varies from case to case, from individual to individual, and also, you know, it's a class thing, and it's a political thing, and it's about who, you know, how you vote or what you want and what you want from political life. Or, you know, certainly in the, you know, the last, well, I'll just say it, you know, in the last 10 days, I would have valued a bit more cynicism about the United States and our project, but that's gone. From
Americans.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, the sense, and maybe you're right. Maybe it's about, you know, being cynical about the rest of the world, but or not knowing. I mean, but the
particularly Americans like on the left, I think, are more cynical about America than Americans on the right. Though Americans on the right are cynical in another way. You know, when we talk about immigration,
right.
You know, hearkening back to some ideal past, and now things aren't working out so well because it's not the ideal past.
Right.
Whereas on the left, it's not so much worrying about an ideal past. It's like improving the present, and the present's not quite as good as it could be.
Right.
Because
right.
We want to get as far away from the past as possible because it's this, you know, ongoing progressive project. And so both become kind of cynical in different ways. If that, I'm Canadian.
Yeah. Easy for you to say.
I'm diagnosing your country for
you. It's not so painful.
When we open this up for questions, you know, I think it could get ugly.
Maybe we should.
Yeah, okay, yeah. We can do that. Okay. On that note, you can now tell me that I'm completely out to lunch. Yeah.
And so you'll have to shout back, and the questioners can have a question. No questions?
I can answer questions in Russian. You can answer questions in Albanian.
Okay. attach these to the here until you can stand up. And,
Hi. I wanted to ask, unfortunately, I haven't read either of your books yet, but I'm going to, your current books. I've read your past books, and I'm very much a fan. But I wanted to ask if each of you could maybe share a little bit about your writing process and, like, your daily, the kind of the work of getting the words onto the page and, like, how you do that. I'm just interested if you guys could, like, tell each kind of answer that. Thanks.
So for the novel, I mean, I generally try to, I'm slow. If I aim to write 500 words a day. If I can write 500 words a day, that's good for me. I often don't make that. I edit as I go, so it takes me a long time to create a first draft. And if I have nothing else to do, meaning I don't have another job, I write every day and try to make that. And if I hit 500 words, even if I'm oftentimes, if I'm not even done the paragraph, I'm like, whoa, 500, okay.
Well, it depends completely on what stage it is. You know, writing a first draft is necessarily slow because you just can't write that. I mean, I read this great quote, and I think it was Joan Acacella who said something like, "It's writing a first draft is really hard work because all the cliches just come pouring into your head, and it's almost like a physical effort to resist them and to do something else." So there's that. But revision, you know, I can work long hours because it's already there, and that terrifying void has been filled. And then there's some days when, you know, I'll write like one line, and it makes me so happy. I'll go, okay, that's it, you know. I mean, I'm working on something now, another novel, and about, I don't know, about a month ago, I wrote this line. The line was something like, I don't mean to name drop, but Picasso told me a story. And I went, okay, that's it for the day. I don't have to do anything else. But, you know,
how long did it take your book?
This book? Yeah. 3 years, maybe? And yours?
I mean, it's from 6 years, but with time off.
Yeah. Well, you know, you have a life. I mean, it's hard. I mean, it's hard.
So my question is about sort of the presentation of self and the presentation of cultural identity. You mentioned earlier, you talked about having to deal with the struggle of portraying a culture to a particular culture. So, for instance, you were talking about showing, for instance, the Soviet experience or, for instance, the Albanian experience to an audience of primarily American readers. So I'm wondering how you sort of negotiate, navigate that sort of, do you ever have to have compromise for the sake of the audience that you know you're going to present to, as opposed to the authenticity of the, you know, perspective that you've chosen to tell your story through, if that makes any sense?
Well, you know, you can only hope that you're getting it right. You know, and it's why, I mean, I found out, you know, often you find out things later that you wish you knew at the beginning. I mean, after the book went into galleys, I was saying earlier to David that a lot of the supers in New York are Albanian. So it turned out that there are all these Albanian supers on my block here. So my husband gave the galleys to one of them, and he gave it to his, he said, well, I don't read. He gave it to his wife. And then he came back and he said, oh, my wife wonders how you know what it's like to be an Albanian girl when you're not one. And I went, like, yes. And he gave me something I wish I had, which is, it turns out there's an Albanian Yellow Pages in Manhattan. It's like that big. You can go from cradle to grave in New York and never deal with anyone who's not Albanian. So, you know, had I known that, I would have certainly talked to more Albanians. And you know, so much is about details. Like, I just feel like if I'm getting little details right, I can do things. But also, one more thing, which is that I mean, at some point in the novel, or actually before the novel begins, Lula works in this bar in the East Village, which
she calls the Mojito District. And my daughter-in-law, who's Mexican, worked in that same bar. So I knew, and I knew the culture of that bar from talking to my daughter-in-law. I mean, she had, you know, and I knew that all the people who were working there were immigrants, that some of them were undocumented, that the busboys were always getting deported and so forth. So I was able to use very particular details of that life and just give them to Lula's life.
I mean, in writing this book and write the previous book, I'm aware of writing for two audiences. So I'm aware that there is an audience of Soviet people who are still alive, who know this world, and so it has to be authentic. But at the same time, I'm aware that it can't be so, first of all, I wouldn't want it to be, but that it wouldn't be so kind of arcane and closed that non-Russian people wouldn't get it. And I realize that I am writing primarily for a non-Russian audience. But it's that balance where you balance one against the other, that it doesn't become, you know, so particular that only the insiders will get it, which isn't interesting anyway. But also that you're trying not to over-explain anything because you think you're dealing with an American audience exclusively. At that point, you're condescending to, you know, your Russian audience. So it's a balance. I have some very basic rules. I use the smallest number of Russian words in the text. I only will introduce a Russian word if it's unavoidable. Right? Like I kind of have like an abuelita theory of writing. You know, I've read a lot of like Latino literature where it's like, oh, abuelita said this and abuelita said that. And it's like, she's grandmother. You know, you can write grandmother. And just like with Russian, it's like you can just write grandmother. You don't have to say babushka all the time. It's like that sort of stuff we get. But if there's a word that, because I believe if I read like an ethnic writer, I believe you're ethnic. I believe you. You don't have to convince me. I get it. So you don't need to like legitimize yourself. But if there are specific details that can't be translated, those you put in. And then, you know, because there's no other way around it.
But also, you know, I really believe in the power of the imagination. I mean, I believe it's possible for women to write from a male point of view and vice versa, and that Americans can write from the point of view of other countries, and that it's possible to imagine your way into another kind of person or another race or another nationality. And when I wrote my novel Household Saints, the one that was made into a movie, the director was it was about Italian Americans in Greenwich Village and in Little Italy, and the director was Italian, and she kept saying, you know, we went out with the movie together, and she kept saying, I can't believe that a Jewish girl got this right. And every time she said it, I had that same feeling of yes, that it was possible. And it was very confirming for me to be able to do it.
Hi, thank you. This has been a wonderful conversation. I'm a little ambivalent about the question, David, but I'm going to ask it. I feel like the writer should kind of disappear and the material should just stand. But I'm currently reading Toni Morrison's Beloved, so I'm thinking all about freedom and the extraordinary subjective moment of going from, in the extreme case, from slavery to freedom, just that second where your entire life changes. So in terms of coming from a place like the Soviet Union with so much that's different in terms of personal freedom or the perception of, you know, the idea of secret police or just a culture that is watching you in different ways. For you or for your family, can you put into words what that sensation was or is?
So the sensation of coming from a repressive, you know, totalitarian culture, it depends. I don't think there's one experience for everybody. I think there's a kind of a shared overall experience, which is, I think it trained people to be suspicious, to be guarded, because you kind of had to be. But over the decades, the Soviet Union wasn't monolithic. I mean, it was one thing under Stalin and a different thing under, you know, Khrushchev, and then a different thing under Brezhnev. And it, you know, it kept getting milder in some way, which is reflected in the book, in that Samuel, who's the oldest, who experienced, you know, life pre-Stalin, is the most severe. And he's, you know, he's the hardest of all of them, because he's seen the worst of the 20th century, really, for him. I mean, from pogroms all the way through the war with the Stalinist years. And because of the nature of what Soviet life was like, at a certain point, especially if you were a party member, he was complicit. And so that changes one's mentality. It got easier later. I mean, you know, Francine talks about how bad does something need to be to get people to leave, because most people don't want to leave and just up and go. And frankly, when the Soviet Union was at its worst, you couldn't leave. The reason these people could leave was that it got just good enough while remaining just bad enough that you could get out. You know, it was just bad enough that you didn't want to stay, and it had become just flexible enough that you could, in not wanting to stay, actually leave. And so, you know, that changed who these people were.
Well, and also they were happy after a while to get rid of the Jews, who were pains in the asses anyhow.
That's something else. I mean, there's anti-Semitism.
There's anti-Semitism in the country, but were they happy to get rid of the Jews? I think for the most part, they resented the Jews for being able to leave. Like, they didn't love the Jews while they were there, and then they resented them for being able to do what most people wanted to do, which was to get out. And there was also the sense that, you know, of resenting them for being, even though there was anti-Semitism, they were still Soviet citizens. And there was resentment that they were, I think for the people who believed it, or maybe some who didn't fully believe it, that they were betraying the communist project, that they were leaving, that they were traitors. You know, that this is a system that had educated them, right? We educated you. We gave you all these things, and now you want to leave. So it's not as simple as, we don't like the Jews. Good riddance. It was like, we don't like you, but you should stay here and be not liked by us.
This question for David. Throughout, you refer to yourself as American. I think on one occasion you called yourself Canadian. And I'm wondering whether you see yourself as a Canadian. I mean, certainly the Latvian, Russian, the Latvian Soviet part of you is very strong. But do you see yourself as a Canadian writer, or do you think there's a difference between Canadian and American writers?
I think there's less and less of a difference now than there ever was. And for me, maybe because it was just so arbitrary where we ended up, where my family ended up, we could have just as easily ended up in America, and we have relatives who ended up here. I kind of feel as at home here as I do in Canada. I mean, there are differences between the countries, for sure, but there are more similarities, and maybe it's a function of having that Soviet people, Soviet Jews, are basically the same in Toronto as they are in New York, as they are in San Francisco, as they are, like, when you meet Soviet people, it's like, oh, yeah, we ended up here, but we're basically kind of, you know, citizens of North America. So for me, maybe because of that, and because I've spent, you know, a fair amount of time in America, I kind of interchangeably say American or Canadian. You know, if it was up to me, I would just get rid of the border. You know, it would just be more comfortable for me. I could just, you know, kind of be, oh, I'll go here and I'll go there. And you know, to me, I feel kind of at home in both places.
Yes.
I will say, okay, so yes, my wife just gave birth, and we were living here, and it was time to give birth. We went back to Canada. And who wants to guess what it cost us? I mean, like, we pay taxes and everything, but, like, who wants to guess what the bill came in? We ended up with a private room, right, meaning she was in the room by herself, in a good hospital. Who wants to guess what my bill was? No, it was a little more than zero. It was $8. It was $8 for the phone, $4 a day.